I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In Kansas City, on both sides of the border, there are good neighborhoods and there are bad neighborhoods. Each comes with a set of preconceptions, ideas about what kinds of people live there and why. So how did this come to be the case, and why is it that the quote-unquote bad parts of our city are largely synonymous with the black and brown parts of town? Today, a conversation hosted by American Public Square on poverty, race, and policy called Who's Your Neighbor? It was held last week at Donnelly College in Kansas City, Kansas. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Today we feature another conversation on the square, this one a panel discussion about poverty, race, health, and the physical space we live in. Sponsored by KCUR and American Public Square, it took place last week at Donnelly College over in Kansas City, Kansas. Introduced here and moderated by KCUR's Brian Ellison.
Neighborhood is a word that a lot of us use many times so that we can describe the people who live in that neighborhood or who we perceive to live in it, without actually mentioning the people. We might talk about a black neighborhood or a Latino neighborhood, as though a set of streets and buildings actually had race. We talk about poor neighborhoods, and we know what we mean by that, but again, it allows us to distance ourselves from talking about the actual people who are living in poverty. There's something else maybe you've noticed. Oftentimes those descriptions of neighborhoods are used interchangeably in casual conversation, especially by people who don't live in them, of course. Poor neighborhoods, black neighborhoods, Hispanic neighborhoods, high crime neighborhoods, maybe all the same neighborhoods. And sometimes when it is spoken by people who don't live there, rough neighborhoods or bad neighborhoods. Urban areas like Kansas City, Kansas, and Missouri provide ample statistics to back the idea that there is a connection between where people live and who lives there and the economic realities of those lives. But how did it come to be that way? Why does it remain that way? And why does it have to? Or does it? That's what we're talking about here today. Reverend Wallace Hartsfield is senior pastor of Metropolitan Missionary Baptist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. He's also professor of Hebrew Bible at Central Baptist Seminary. He's given leadership to many groups and projects across the metro. Dr. Hartsfield, I want to start by asking you a question that acknowledges that as a pastor, you are a leader of one of the metro's preeminent institutions, comprising African Americans of various neighborhoods and income levels. My question is, do you agree with that perception that poverty and geography and race are so frequently linked in this city's neighborhoods? And can you talk about why, or at least why so many people have that perception?
Yes, I would definitely think there's a connection. Where I come from, we don't even always say neighborhood. We just call it the hood. And I think that's an interesting way of framing my remarks, because there's a sense that there's not a feeling of neighborliness. It's just a covering for people to gather and survive the best way you're able to. And in the hood, because you have that kind of interaction oftentimes between persons, their poverty looks like substandard living conditions. Poverty looks like unemployment rates that tend to be 2 to 3 times more than the average unemployment rate. It looks like an area where people are unable to access credit, just consumer credit. Therefore, it's riddled with payday lenders. Payday lenders become the financial institutions of the neighborhoods where I am. There's the whole matter of illiteracy that's directly connected with poor educational institutions. And so I think that there is absolutely a connection between poverty and particular neighborhoods, especially neighborhoods of color. I'm not going to suggest that I know all the answers to that. All I know is that there's a commonality no matter where you are, where you go in this nation. When you go into neighborhoods that tend to be predominantly African American, or there's Latinos there or other ethnic groups, and they're together, those areas tend to be impoverished areas. So there is a connection. I would suggest that that connection has to do with a lack of neighborliness that leads to lack of all kinds of resources.
We'll flesh that out as this conversation unfolds. Let me introduce Denise Dowd. She is an attending physician in the emergency department of Children's Mercy Hospital, also professor of pediatrics at UMKC and adjunct professor at KU. She has degrees in public health as well as medicine. She's both a scholar and a practitioner. The practice part going back 30 years, starting as a nurse in urban Detroit. 40 years. I'm sorry. Let me just update that.
Yes.
You started younger than I realized. The scholar part includes research on the connection between adversity and trauma and child health. Which, just to say, Dr. Dowd, maybe it feels like you've seen it all, either in the books and the numbers or in the emergency room. What have you seen that speaks to the hard reality of poverty and health in the different neighborhoods that you have served?
Well, I've had the advantage of having a sort of what you'd call a front row seat to the dramas of people's life, the toughest times in their life when their children are sick or critically injured. So from that vantage point in Chicago and in Detroit and in Kansas City, I've seen a lot of things. And what I think I've seen is this idea that children come into the world, they're not criminals when they come into the world, they're healthy when they come into the world. And they have the full potential to do amazing things. And in large part, kids are pretty much blank slates when they come into the world. And more than anything, what I've learned, it's not their genetics that shape what happens to them over time in the arc of their lives with regard to their health outcomes, both physical and mental, with regard to the success that they have in life, their relationships. What determines that are their circumstances. And the circumstances many children in Kansas City have to deal with are, for most of us, if we had to deal with them, it would kill me to have to deal with them. They're that tough. They're that difficult, both from the effects of poverty, segregation, and institutionalized racism, among another of different factors. And we know now that it's this thing called toxic stress that shapes kids' brains from a very early age. So there's actual physical structure changes in the brain. And for years we thought, well, those are just bad circumstances and they lead to bad choices. But what we know now, and this is the tragedy that we must act on, is that this is shaping children's brains from the time that they're born, probably before they're born. I don't think it's hyperbole. It's the greatest public health crisis of our times, and we can do something about it.
We'll talk more about that too. Daniel Serta, you're an urban planner whose work and interests have ranged from consulting on big downtown developments to crafting neighborhood business districts to serving on boards that coordinate regional transportation. And you've taught about all this at KU, but you also live here in KCK. You've worked with the unified government on urban redevelopment. I can think of very few people who know the city's neighborhoods and their realities and challenges from a city planning standpoint, as well as you do. So let me step back and ask you to talk about what a neighborhood is and what you have seen in them. How much does that construct, that label, shape the lives of the people who live there, and should it?
I call the structural aspect of neighborhoods, which is the physical infrastructure, the layout of the streets, the size and the scale of the homes, and the kinds of institutions that you see represented there, whether it's churches and philanthropic entities or whether you're talking about commercial businesses and other kind of entities. Part of the glue that constitutes urban neighborhoods, there are a few essential ingredients. The first is density. The second is the heterogeneity of the people there, the diversity of people, as we tend to say these days. And the third is the regular interacting and intermingling of those folks on a day-to-day basis in different contexts. But that kind of bubbling and percolating of life in a neighborhood is what distinguishes urban areas. So those are kind of the structural dimensions of a neighborhood. What I think is most interesting and most challenging in the context of this conversation is that for every reality, there is the perception of that reality. So all of the things that have been mentioned so far, whether it's the health conditions or the structural conditions of economic challenges, of social challenges, of the kind of anguish, the kind of personal struggle the people engage with the neighborhoods, all of that happens. All of that happens on the ground. But we as humans are always trying to make meaning of the patterns that we see. And in the context of neighborhoods, we try to simplify that. We try to make sense of it. We like to see patterns. We like to see a certain sort of orderly sense of the world around us and try to understand that. So we start adopting sort of a nomenclature of different places. That's the good side of town. That's the bad side of town. The people there are one way, the people there are that way. I mean, there are so many innumerable ways I could imagine talking about how we've divided up our description of the geography of this metropolitan area. We talk about north of the river, south of the river, over in KCK and whatever description you use, all of that carries embedded meanings that are shared. It's something that we're conditioned with, and it's part of our public discourse about things. And in the same way that simplifying reality can be helpful for understanding, it can very much get in the way of understanding. And that is one of the things that personally I find so challenging and at times very frustrating about the work that I do professionally. Your description at the beginning, Brian, I was thinking, gosh, Brian's talking about all the reasons I decided to become an urban planner when I was about 19 years old. It was having grown up in a neighborhood in Kansas City, Kansas, that was barely recognized as such, even by the city government. I grew up in Armourdale at a time when it had been emptying out in very dramatic ways. Before the 1951 flood, there were over 20,000 people living and working in Armourdale. Today, there are about 3,000 people that still call it home. And when I was a kid growing up, there were probably about 6,000 people, which means that half the neighborhood is gone just since I became an adult in the last 25 years or so. You know, I grew up in a place that was changing. I didn't understand why it was changing. I wanted to understand why it was changing. But one thing I knew from a very early age is that at least some part of how and why it was changing had a lot to do with the way that it was perceived. The way it was perceived by the people that lived there, by the way it was not perceived by people that didn't live there, that didn't even know that it existed, by the way it was even perceived by people in city government. And that overlay of perceptions against reality, like I said, I think it can be helpful, but it can also very much get in the way.
So let me ask all of you a question that maybe sounds just too simplistic already based on what we've heard, but I think it gets at the heart of a lot of what we're talking about here tonight. Why are communities of color connected with being communities where poverty is prevalent? Why is that happening in our metropolitan area? Maybe there's simple answers for that. Maybe there's some very complicated answers for that. I invite all of you to weigh in.
Where's the civility bill? It feels dangerous to touch this, but one of the things that I think of, because I'm just a healthcare person, so I'm really kind of out of my element a little bit here, is we know that there are massive health disparities by zip code and census tract in the city. That is a fact. Life expectancy from Johnson County to Wyandotte County, I think, is on the order, fact checker will have to do this, but on the order of 20 years difference or thereabouts. It's the same thing in Kansas City, Missouri. This is a fact. So why does that happen? Now, the health department recently, they just published a really wonderful report taking a look at health disparities and then tracing tracing it to the history of segregation in our city. And according to, and I don't know which website this was, but Kansas City currently is among the most segregated of cities in the United States, is one of the most very segregated cities to this day.
So Denise, let me back up what you're saying with numbers, because I looked up that study you're talking about. The study grouped the different zip codes in the Kansas City, Missouri. So at the top of the list is a group of 8 zip codes, mostly in the, and I'm mindful of the terminology is implicit now, but mostly in the Northland, suburban sections of Platte and Clay County, and a couple zip codes, including the Plaza, Westport, Brookside. And then the bottom of the list is a group of 6 zip codes clustered together, bounded by the Paseo, Independence Avenue, Bannister, Van Brunt, 435 on the east side of it. The top group has a life expectancy of 81 to 83 years on average. The bottom, 70 to 72 years. Median household income, $97,000 versus $30,000. The bottom group of zip codes, you're twice as likely to die of cancer, twice as likely to die of heart disease, twice as likely to die of stroke, 3 times as likely to die of diabetes, and 22 times likelier to be murdered. And the racial composition in the top group is 16% non-white, and in the bottom group, it's 83% non-white, to your point. Health disparities are one aspect of this. What else?
You know, I think we tend to think of neighborhoods as somewhat static, and they're not. They're changing all the time. People are constantly moving in and moving out and that sort of thing. And one of the things, I always joke about this, is that, you know, planners like to develop 20-year plans. And when we do that, we assume we're not going to be 20 years older when we get to that 20-year point, right? And the reality is the world's going to change a lot between now and then. So Wyandotte County, I've said this many times, I can count on one hand the number of classmates that I'm aware of that still live in Kansas City, Kansas. Those with ambition, those with opportunity, went where the ambition and the opportunity would take them. And I don't think we should necessarily be surprised by that. But to me, it just underscores the reality that access to educational opportunity and access to employment opportunity is a fundamental driver. And the reality is that there is no way to understand the resulting geography of race and class, whether in this city or any city, without acknowledging that there are very disparate outcomes for different people based not just where they started from, but based on the racial background. And there is so much of it that it cannot simply be explained away by ill fortune or chance. It points to the reality that there are systemic processes at work that disadvantage different people depending on the racial or ethnic background. I think the reality is, particularly at a, you know, national level and a policy context, we tend to talk about misfortune as if though it is a consequence of a moral failing on the part of the individuals that are suffering that misfortune, as opposed to understanding that it is a reflection of the struggles against the circumstances that people find themselves in. It's a little bit like the phrase, "there but for the grace of God go I." There's always been something about that phrase that was a little unsettling to me. And I finally started realizing a few years ago what it was. And it's the idea that the speaker and that first person is essentially saying, and I'm glad that's not me. Well, at the same time, they're acknowledging, it maybe could have been, but probably not. I'm glad it's not me. I think the reality is, if you were ever to switch, and you said this, Denise, why would you switch places with someone facing those constraints? Would anyone deliberately choose to do that? No. But what choice does an infant have about who their mother is? What choice does an immigrant have about who their parent is or where they live? We are all constrained by circumstances that are not of our own making. And the fact that you can't overcome that, I don't think it's a sign of moral failing. I think it's a sign that there are serious structural inequities out there that need to be addressed by the entire society.
Right, and that's where I'd like to try to pick up and build on what you just said, Daniel. It's a reflection of the circumstances that people find themselves in. There's no secret that within the Kansas City, Missouri area, the segregated quarters in which we live was not something that just happened by chance. That was something that was systematically done and is continued and continues in certain respects. But whether we talk about the blockbusting, whether we talk about the redlining, the whole idea of what we talk about, the perception of East of Truce, that's not accidental. That is orchestrated not only by private real estate owners, but that was done in conjunction with government entities. When white flight took place from some of the zip codes that you're talking about where life expectancy is not that high, the only way that whites could have gone to some of the places that they went was because it was made possible with new highways being brought in. That gave an escape route, essentially. By constructing 71, that came right down the middle, just tore up neighborhoods, so much to the point that when you talk about persons in third district and so forth, not only did white flight take place, but black flight took place. But then you have those who are left who can't take flight. You can go anywhere in this nation. There are some people who can't take advantage of so-called opportunity. And as long as you have neighborhoods where there is not intentional economic injections into that neighborhood, you essentially keep people as slaves. I don't know a better way of saying it. You know, I always think about the founding of this country. It was not founded with everyone in mind. You know, when I think of myself, I oftentimes have to say, you know, essentially I'm an amendment here. You know, we get a 13th Amendment that abolishes slavery. That's just, you know, then we get a 14th Amendment that gives citizenship, and you get a 15th Amendment that gives a right to vote. But even though slavery has been abolished, there's citizenship and a right to vote, there still has not been access and opportunity to economic possibility. That's what's so devastating. You can have legislative changes, you can have policy changes, and people's lives will never change still. For me, at the heart of this matter of neighborhood and poverty, it is an economic issue. The trauma that I think I hear Denise speaking about, there's so much about the lack of economics that drives, that fuels so much of that. I think sometimes we talk about it and we make it like it's a coincidence or a happenstance. Neighborhoods are changing. Well, interesting thing about it is that when the neighborhood that was just discussed changes, most likely, if it moves according to historical trajectories, what will happen is that the poor people that are there now will be displaced and just go someplace else, unless there is systematic intentionality that seeks to liberate the persons that we have there.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's program, wine expert Doug Frost and Room 39 owner Chef Ted Habiger joined us. We had a lot of fun. Hear our conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, learn a little bit about the profitability of recycling, and we'll speak with a woman who was at Pearl Harbor when the Pacific Fleet came under attack back in 1941. Be sure to join us for that. Let's return to our American Public Square discussion on neighborhoods, poverty, and race. Up to date, Steven Steigman served as the floor reporter and is putting an audience question to the panel.
For our panel, do you feel that HUD policies have helped or hindered racial integration in Kansas City and overall? And how do we best incentivize structural change in urban areas? And perhaps the political question in this is, What about a possible Ben Carson leadership of HUD? And what does that pretend for Kansas City?
The first question obviously is fairly loaded. Have they helped or they hindered? It's been both. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt it's been both. Anytime you're talking about government allocating resources, that is the meat and that is the messiness of what we call politics. And it is shaped by every interest group and every constituency in every way, good or bad, that you can imagine. You know, in the last couple of decades, there have been HUD-led initiatives that have done everything from provide greater access to opportunity in communities to removing hundreds, if not thousands, of units of affordable and public housing from the existing stock within cities throughout the United States. So there's no easy answer to the first part. It's a combination of all of those things. But clearly what's going to change is the availability of those resources over time. Given the political tenor of the times, the expectation is that that's really not something, it's not a business the federal government should be in. Let's put it that way.
I agree with everything that Daniel has said. The only thing I would add is that I don't think it's helpful when we have HUD programs that are just low-income programs. Essentially, successful neighborhoods need a stratification of classes, and you cannot have a successful neighborhood with simply low income. If we're going to go after integration, let's really do that. Unfortunately, we've said that in our policies that we want integration, but our actions have demonstrated that we prefer segregation. I would think that HUD can help if HUD could really challenge a repopulation effort into some of these areas that's integrative.
So I feel like we're not giving the folks with the civility bells quite enough to do out there. So I'm going to follow up with the question that someone asked specifically about President-elect Trump's nomination of Ben Carson. And part of the appeal is that he grew up in an urban setting. He did not grow up in a housing project. But the idea that he sort of pulled himself up by his bootstraps, are you pleased with that appointment? And does that story bode well for the purpose of that agency?
Well, let me say two things about that. I was telling somebody the other day, you know, I've been dealing with housing policy, community development, all these things for a long time, but now I guess I can't actually properly describe it as being more complicated than brain surgery. So I think absolutely a big part of what's going on is, as I said before, there's going to be a shrinking role in terms of direct involvement on the part of HUD, particularly in terms of dollars coming from Washington. And to your last point of how much does it matter who runs the agency, you better believe it matters. Even if the role shrinks, it's going to happen gradually over time. We're still talking billions of dollars in money appropriated to HUD. We're talking about, I mean, multiple layers of legislation, particularly around fair housing, that have been structured over decades that potentially will get peeled back. The one part of that you probably heard about it that I'm sure will be on day one is there was a particular interpretation of the Fair Housing Act that the Obama administration has been promulgating that deals with the reluctance of suburban communities to essentially zone for and permit and promote affordable and lower income housing within suburban communities. And you better believe that's a huge issue everywhere, including in Kansas City. I was just talking to a city council member, I won't say where, about 2 weeks ago about this, and he said, we're having real issues in our town because our town not only doesn't want affordable housing, they don't want multifamily housing, period.
I don't know much about housing, but I do know about neurosurgeons, and just we have to remember the tool he's most familiar with is a scalpel. I think we need to think about that.
Yeah. I hear you. Well, I don't.
It was fact-based. Yeah. I didn't hear any bells, so I guess we'll move on. Wallace, I'm sorry.
I have no idea what will happen with Dr. Carson. Here's my concern about this whole notion of pulling up by your own bootstraps. The problem I have with that is that's the thing that a lot of our kids are taught within our public schools. It's about getting a ticket out of here and going to work to just promote the big corporate America. But our education needs to teach, how do we use this education that I have to build this community, those who are not fortunate enough, even though they work just as hard, to receive the opportunity, because it's almost like a lottery getting out of some of these neighborhoods. When they don't make it out, the thing that you hear from supposedly successful people is that the others didn't make it out because they're lazy and they're shiftless. That's a stereotype that has been utilized, and that suggests we didn't do like Dr. Carson. So I don't think that's a helpful model. Now, what that has to do with whether he'll be successful, I pray to God that he is successful, but I'm not really seeing it.
Another question, Stephen.
Brian, I have to bring up the G word here, gentrification. How can growth in Kansas City, Kansas, benefit all its current residents and not follow the path of so many other Kansas City area neighborhoods?
You know, everything about a gentrification process is not evil. What has been evil is gentrification that ultimately displaces. The question is, how do we empower persons that are presently living in the neighborhood so that when others from the outside come into the neighborhood, it's not as if they have to just control everything? Can there be a sharing? I don't believe that it can be done without some degree of gentrification. If we are going to do integration, then let's do that. If we're not, let's say that and stop acting under the guise of supposed integration when really all we're doing is creating segregated neighborhoods, and what happens is that the poor continue to be moved from one place to another.
Daniel, I know you work with a lot of development. How do folks who are motivated by profit take an interest in either reducing the segregation that Wallace is talking about or improving the quality of life for the people who already live in the neighborhood?
Well, I think it starts with what Wallace is pointing out. The pro or con of gentrification is largely about who benefits. And so if you start with at least acknowledging that, then to me it immediately raises the question of how can you ensure that those who are already in the community are going to benefit and at the same time not be overly burdened by whatever happens? If you live in a neighborhood like, say, the west side of Kansas City, Missouri, where lots that had houses on them that could be bought for $5,000 or $10,000 back in the 1980s or 1990s are now selling for $125,000 for the dirt so that somebody can build a $750,000 house there. If as a consequence of that, within 2 years, when the county reappraises the property, your property tax bill doubles and you're elderly and on a fixed income, what are you going to do? On both sides of the state line, there has been a tendency to pursue the larger, glitzier, typically higher end, especially housing developments. You do it incrementally. When you do things incrementally and you're looking at it one project at a time, sometimes you miss the bigger picture of what's getting fashioned around you until it's already there and you're really dealing with the consequences of it. But it starts with recognizing that challenge of helping to balance the benefits and mitigate against those burdens being imposed unfairly along people that have been there the entire time. Why do we wait until a developer from outside the neighborhood is interested in plonking a big development down before a local government's going to think seriously about upgrading the infrastructure, improving the streets, improving the quality of the schools in the area? Right? I mean, shouldn't we be doing all of those kinds of things all along?
Denise, I want to ask you a question about how the provision of healthcare fits into this. Can you put a face on that for us? Tell us what that really means when we say people are more likely to die of disease. How do you even address that as a healthcare provider?
It has very little to do, just to the solution, has very little to do with the delivery of health services, at least in the traditional sense. You know, there's this thing called the health determinants model for outcomes, and about 10% of all of health outcomes have to do with what a doctor does. The great portion of it is the environment that you live in, the behaviors that you have, the toxins in the environment you're exposed to, both physical toxins as well as what we're calling now toxic stress. And those are the things that are induced by poverty and the exposures to those stresses. What I do, truthfully, in my clinical work has very little to do with impacting their lives overall. And so to do that, we have to get out of the hospital and we have to get into the community. And the other big part of this, I think, is the solutions. The people, the families that we work with, they already know what the answers are. We don't need to come from the outside and say, here, I know what's best. Here's the answer. They already know. You just have to ask.
Well, and solutions, I think, is where we want to get to. But let's take one more question first here as we continue talking about these sort of the underlying causes and issues.
This is a really interesting question. In my volunteer work in the urban core, I perceive that in addition to race issues, there are class issues. For example, African Americans higher on the scale on the socioeconomic ladder are often dismissive or outright hostile to African Americans who are lower on the scale. The same dynamic seems to exist for Latinos. Is this for real or is it just my perception, and how do we deal with this?
I personally think that's for real. There's so much about America that is shaped by class that race and class oftentimes exist together. This has to do with economics. Martin King dealt so much with the economic condition. And he said something like, I feel like I've led my people into a burning building, because he felt like they had gone through getting a lot of policy changes and legislation changes accomplished, but the lives of people had not changed at all. And so King said it's no excuse for America, with all the resources that it has, that anybody who wants to work and is willing to work should not be able to get a job. America should be able to provide that. But King criticized the country and said, unfortunately, the twins of economic deprivation and racial discrimination lies at the heart of this country. And this country does not recognize that it is sick. There's probably no bigger industry, not only in this nation, but in the world, than that of poverty exploiting poor people. When poor people have to use convenience stores for grocery stores and use payday lending institutions for banks, this is huge exploitation. And I'm really not sure whether this nation, without just a radical transformation, whether this nation can be saved. Because at this point, there's too much money to be made in the exploitation of the poor. Profits are more important than the people in this.
I want to ask a question about the theme of tonight's event. We haven't really talked about it yet, not to minimize the systemic changes, but on an individual level, what would it look like for people in our community to really, using the religious language, love their neighbor as themselves? What could people do to reach across neighborhood lines or within neighborhood lines and really make a difference?
Well, my wife and I have thought about this very deliberately. And we looked lots of different places. We ended up living in a place that's about a mile from where my wife grew up and a mile from where I grew up. We decided we wanted to be there for a few reasons. One was because I think both of us have a personal commitment that is based on, you know, values that have to do with what we're talking about tonight. As a professional urban planner, I feel an ethical obligation to live the kind of opportunity that I would like to see other people living. And we live in an area that is very diverse racially, it's diverse economically. I don't know how long it'll be like that, because there are people that would like to see it change in certain ways. This question of neighbors, you know, my neighbor across the street is a veteran who is on disability because he suffers from PTSD. My neighbor next door used to own my house. She's lived in the house where she lives now since she and her husband built it over 50 years ago. My neighbor two doors away is a Hispanic family, as is the neighbor across the street. The neighbor's next door, African American. We're all from different walks of life. It's mostly working class. But we made a very deliberate decision about wanting to be in that kind of place, and especially about wanting to raise our children in that kind of place. That's how people have to make those kinds of choices, because, as I always say, you know, change always starts with yourself. Balanced, of course, by thinking about promoting opportunity for others that are less fortunate than yourselves.
I think one of the ways to help out is to do what you can to gain knowledge of people on a person-to-person level, and not to speak badly of people that work in soup kitchens and all that, but when you have a service delivery model, when you're doing volunteer work that has a power differential in it, you know, I have the food, I'm giving it to you, there's a dynamic that doesn't allow you to really get to know somebody as just a person. I think about Amethyst Place, which is a place for women in recovery that's on Truce, and there's a wonderful mentorship program there. And it's a two-way street. You have dinner, you know, every couple of weeks or so, and it's called mentorship, but really, it's just really getting to know somebody as a person, just as a person. And I think those simple things, that it's kind of ordinary magic. I mean, you just get to know, people have the same concerns about their children, their own lives, as you do. We're so much, you know, more similar than we are different, to use an overused phrase. But just put yourself in situations to get to know somebody on an equal level.
I would agree with what has been stated. We have to be intentional about developing communities. My wife and I have developed a piece that's called Kansas City Inner City Pioneers, because we sought to really try to encourage a repopulation effort. But what we continue to hear from people is that, well, we'll come when there's a better school, or when there's a grocery store or something else like that. And what we ended up finding out is that if some of these things are going to really happen and we're going to have integrated communities, it's going to take a pioneering mentality. Persons that are going to come in and say, listen, before the school is here, before the store is here, and to take part in the building of that kind of community. Ultimately, that has to become the way things are done in the majority of instances in our nation if we're going to change the path that we are on. I think a whole lot has to do with our young adults. We need our youngsters to make the decision to change the way we have done things here in this nation. It's going to be hard for persons my age and older, because we've just been ingrained, or segregation is big in us. We need our young group to be intentional, because you all can make these neighborhoods. You can be intentional about it and make it happen.
Stephen, one last set of questions from the audience.
Sure. There seem to be a lot of Caucasian people who live in rural areas or even urban areas who have low incomes and limited opportunities. They seem to be angry and think non-white people have received special treatment from our government. They feel left out and left behind. What can be done to provide opportunities to them in their neighborhoods?
Call me a conspiratist. But this is another thing that I think has been done by design. Pitting poor whites against poor people of color. When you look in the history of our nation, there's a frightening piece that happens with that. If Trump is not successful, especially many of the poor whites or the working whites that put him in, what will most likely happen is that people of color will be blamed for it. That in some kind of way we didn't support him. We didn't make it happen. It's because we have this heavy baggage, this heavy load that has to be carried, these lazy, shiftless people. Here is again an opportunity, and I speak to the young people because I'm just not sure whether or not folks my age and older will just dare to make this decision. But I really wish our young people those who are poor, black and white, will just make the decision not to follow some of the mess that this nation has engaged in for so long. Call me a conspiratist, but I believe that's by design.
Anyone else?
Well, it is interesting to know that everybody remembers the crack epidemic of the 80s.
Right.
Now we have an opiate epidemic right now, and it's predominantly in poor white communities. Mm-hmm. In the history of the crack epidemic, who was blamed for that? Mm-hmm. Poor black community was blamed for that. What's happening now with the opiate epidemic? You know who's blamed for that? The people that are writing the prescriptions, mm-hmm. not the people that are using the drugs. Mm-hmm. It's just an interesting observation. Mm-hmm. Just an observation to think about. I'm not a conspiracy theorist either, but there is some circumstantial evidence that would point a certain way.
I don't think you need to go to rural America to find working class whites that blame minorities for undeserved privileges. I had a conversation like that with one of my neighbors, and I still consider that person a neighbor. Mm-hmm. I think what the Reverend is saying is just so incredibly important in this. People don't recognize the degree to which people have been manipulated in ways that undermine not only the circumstances of the people you're complaining about, but your own circumstances. You're facing the same challenge. You're facing the same set of challenges. I think when people look back at the time we're in right now, 50, 100 years from now, I think people are just going to be very puzzled about this issue of why so many people seem to act politically in ways that were adverse to their own interests. I want to throw one last little thought in there. This is absolutely integral to the debate or lack thereof that we have in this country about immigration policy. This idea that somehow there is a group of people that follow the noble path and they're all of these lawbreakers that are doing things the other way, without ever acknowledging that most of those folks that followed the path the right way, there was no path. There were no rules. My father immigrated to this country when he was 4 years old. That was over a century ago. There were no restrictions on immigration from Mexico at the time. He needed a green card. He got one. He applied for it at the border. It was issued to him directly. He walked across and he became a legal permanent resident. Until we're willing to acknowledge that groups are being played against each other, that there are those who economically benefit from keeping people lurking in the shadows, we are never going to make any progress. And frankly, I don't think we're ever going to be able to live up to any of the ideals that we claim to follow.
What we haven't had time to talk about, and we are out of time, is the opportunities to see glimpses of hope. But this always has been intended to be the beginning of a conversation. These conversations at the Square are never the final word on any problem that we will ever take on. My hope is that we will continue that conversation. Places like this, on the radio, in communities where these are not just theoretical conversations, but people's lives. I want to thank Dr. Daniel Serta, Dr. Denise Dowd, and Dr. Wallace Hartsfield II. Thank you.
You can listen to previous programs and download our podcast. Just go to kcur.org/uptodate. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR UpToDate. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, the profitability of recycling. Also, a child of Pearl Harbor recalls the attack and what life was like after the war. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.